We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, Blue Wire listeners. I'm Greg Olson. I'm excited to partner with Blue Wire to bring you TE1. A podcast where I interview the tight ends who have revolutionized the position. Listen in as I have raw, in-depth conversations with the all-time greats like Shannon Sharp, Tony Gonzalez, Travis Kelce, and George Kittle. We'll explore how the tight end position has changed over the last 60 years and what it takes to be the very best. Subscribe to TE1 from Blue Wire Studios today so you're ready for the August premiere.
Welcome to In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots Podcast. We're your hosts, Shamit Duup and Mason Ginsburg, and this is All Pelicans All the Time.
Welcome to In the Know. This episode is brought to you by betonline.ag for all your sports betting needs because the NBA is back. And because the NBA is back, we have our favorite guest, Michael McNamara, here to preview the restart with us. Mac, what's going on, man? How you been hanging out in Utah? Last we kind of heard from you, you had COVID-19. What was that like, and how are you feeling now?
Wasn't bad physically. Mentally, it was rough. I ran out of TV shows and movies really quick and had to settle for some things that I'm not too proud of watch, but doing good now. And excited to jump on this pod because you guys promised me that I would get an hour of Mason puppy conversation. That's why I'm here.
Okay, given the way you tweet, I'm curious, what could you possibly be embarrassed about watching?
It was a corny, so Upload on Amazon Prime, like, it just wasn't a good show. And I
bailed on that after like two or three episodes.
That's what I would do normally. Like, normally the first episode I'd give a shot and I'd be like, nope, not worth my time. And I stuck through the whole thing and just kind of embarrassed by it. Watched a lot of bad action films that I'm not too proud of. But yeah, Upload is the one that just, in no other situation would I have finished that show, but went all the way through.
Yeah, I remember you updating us about it in the group chat as you were watching it. Definitely seemed like a hate watch situation.
Yeah, I mean, it had an interesting premise. I'm sure that's why Mason watched it, but it was just like it was
and the reviews weren't bad. And so that kind of helped make my final decision. I don't think they were great, but I don't think they were like awful.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the one from me, but happy to report out of that. Only have time for good TV now, watching Dave, a show that I really wish somebody would have told me about while I was quarantining. But that's pretty much what I'm up to right now. And looking at pictures of Mason's puppy.
Speaking of Mason, how is the puppy? It's been a couple weeks now since you've gotten him, maybe just over a week or so. How is he adapting, and how are you guys adapting?
Yeah, he's 10 weeks old. We've had him for 2.5 weeks now, and I think the overall work effort and taking care of a puppy is about what I expected, but I think it's just coming in different ways. Like, it's more mentally exhausting, and just always having to have eyes on the pup to make sure that it's not doing anything you shouldn't. I think the worst part, and I think I said this to Schmidt last time we talked, but he's more of a biter than I expected, and I'm hoping that goes with time, but we'll see.
Yeah, definitely give him some time to get used to you guys and get used to being a big old pup. But, you know, I'm glad you're having fun with him, and I'm very jealous every time I see the pictures that you post. So keep on sending them over. But to transition to basketball speak, we have a lot to talk about on our episode. We have a couple topics, and I feel like we can just start right off with a topic that I'm pretty passionate about. I recently wrote an article about draft strategy, and honestly, I'm excited to talk to Mac about this because this idea all came together a few months ago. Mac and I got on a Zoom call, and you know, we had mapped out what we were going to do with regards to draft strategy. I think, and Mac, it may have been when you were quarantining, and you were like, you know, I don't really like how people define hit rate when it comes to drafts, and I don't really think teams are successful because all these guys that teams end up drafting, you know, none of them really stick around for much longer. You know, they don't really stick around for a second contract. And you look at contenders, you know, like how many contenders have like first round picks that are role players that they've, you know, that are homegrown instead of outsourced. And you know, we were kicking this idea around, figuring out, is there a good way to measure all this, and what needs to happen in order to get it done? And it was kind of a project that ended up spanning many months. But I think, you know, you guys had a chance to read the article. I wanted to get your thoughts on it first before we get into the meat of the discussion.
Yeah, I'm curious what Mason thinks, because I never really got to talk to him on his perspective of this. So what were kind of your initial thoughts when you read it, Mason?
Well, so it's hard because I already had preconceived biases from reading the discussions. And I know that, you know, I haven't been really as close to the conversation as both of y'all, but I've been keeping up and kind of knew what the conclusion was, while reading. So, one, I wanted to shout out the overall structure to it. And it's not easy, to write something like this that's as insightful and takes as much effort, and also like put the time into the other parts of it, like all the different infographics or charts that really help to make it more digestible for a lot of people. So that I thought that was awesome. And I'm also a little bit insulted in the last sentence, and I do want to talk about that after we get into the real meat of the article around the idea. Without this article, it would be another idea lost in a flow of group chat. And that's a personal attack on every single one of us. Maybe me especially, with the bad puns, people probably just check out for days at a time. But yeah, I'm gonna let you defend yourself on that first.
What is there to defend? We talk about like 3.5 million things in our group chat, and none of us actually end up writing about it. And it's true. And I think sometimes you just need that support from people that are equally passionate about discussing this with you, but also, you know, just having that brain trust of people that are one, knowledgeable, but two, kind of on the same wavelength when it comes to being curious about these things.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the motivating factor in getting this kind of stuff done.
Yeah, absolutely. But no, I mean, all jokes aside, I think it's interesting personally because of the sense that I was never a fit over best player available guy. Like I've always firmly believed that you take the best player regardless of how he fits on your specific roster. But that said, I was always I think I was thinking the right way for the wrong reasons, in the sense that I like taking the guy who you think is has a chance to be a stud versus the safe play, just because of the low percentage of picks that tend to work out even at the top of the draft. But I never thought about it in the context of the value that player will bring to your team over the course of, you know, his time with that team. And so I thought that aspect was very interesting. And it made me realize that maybe I was thinking in the right way, or thinking of the right answer, but in the wrong way. And so I thought it was really well done.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. I think one of the more surprising findings for me, I think this is something I discovered relatively early in the stage, because it was one of the first things I wanted to check out when we were talking about, like, okay, well, you know, how much value is this guy going to bring over a duration of the contract? And I think we all kind of loosely understood that typically young players take a few years to produce more than, let's say, an average replacement level player, even though we hadn't really quantified that or figured out what that mean. First thing I really wanted to quantify was not their production, but to kind of look at roster turnover rate, because if it's taking 3 or 4 years for my rookie to be up to NBA speed, then what does my roster look like, and why does drafting for fit even matter? And I think one of the biggest takeaways from that for me was the league on average is turning over basically over 70% of their roster every 3 years. I mean, that's an enormous turnover rate. And yeah, there's been teams that have had a high continuity over the 3 year stretch, and those are typically teams that you might find that are contenders, that are in their contender window, and they're trying to keep that core together. Although Seth Partnow of The Athletic recently requested that data from me so he can map out win percentage and the continuity, and he found a very slight correlation, so there isn't like a very strong one. But you know, you would expect the teams at the top were, you know, your peak Golden State teams, your peak Spurs teams, the Heatles. And that kind of makes sense, because those are teams that are in their title window. But, you know, for all others, if you have such high roster turnover, like, why even bother? Why even bother justifying this positional fit when your roster is just going to be completely different?
Yeah, I mean, you can say it better. And yeah, this has been in my head for a while. Just to go to the origins, I will put my NFL and NBA draft knowledge up against literally anybody in the world. There is nothing that I study for and look at and remember. I mean, my wife and I basically, like, we don't celebrate our anniversary, the day we met, anything like that. But every single year on the NFL draft, that is our night. Like, we spend a year thinking about, basically our tradition is what pizza we're going to create. It has to be like the most out of the box, insane idea for a pizza you've ever heard of. And we spend.
Don't say like, it.
Sean. And you guys haven't done ramen pizza?
No.
Oh, we've done way more exotic than that. like my wife did a Thai version of the pizza that you talked about, that's like way beyond. Anyway, so that just goes to say that, like, the draft, I would say the only thing I might know better than the draft is Seinfeld. I could literally put on a Seinfeld episode at any point on any episode and tell you what the next line is going to be. Those are the two things I know of more than anything in the world. And I go back and I watch the old drafts anytime they're on NBA TV or NFL Network. And it's the same thing every time. You'll see, you know, the Cleveland Cavaliers select, or what one was I watching the other day? I was watching the one where I think they select not somebody selects like a two guard, and somebody much better was obviously on the board. And it's the same thing every draft. They'll say, well, this guy fits into his lineup, and then they'll show the projected starting lineup, and the reason they didn't take the power forward is because they already have this guy there, whatever. And then in retrospect, you know that 2 years later they lose Carlos Boozer or whatever. And it's so obvious in retrospect that every single draft mistake is for the exact same reason, yet teams make it. And then you combine that with what you were saying before. My old podcast partner, Ryan Schwan, used to put out the same article every year right before the draft, where he would basically look at the draft slots and what you're likely to get. He had an A player, B player, C player. I think a C player was like a sixth man through an eighth man or whatever. But it always felt wrong to me because the hit rates were fairly high. And just watching the draft, I know that that's not the case. And it didn't feel right because of what you said. People look at the guy's career. So when that chart is made 10 years from now, Austin Rivers will count as either a B or a C player because people will look at his career. But for the team that actually drafted him, he was an F player. He did nothing of any consequence. He was worse than what a minimum level guy would be. Same with, like, look at a Ben McLemore and what he did for Sacramento. Now, he might be good for Houston, and maybe he goes on to have five really good years as a sixth man. And when people look back at that draft pick, they'll grade him as a B or C player, but he was an F for the team that actually drafted him. So, you know, moving forward to the Pelicans having probably another lotto pick this year and maybe the last one they'll have for the next 10 years, I thought it was really interesting to start thinking about what the likelihood of actual success for that pick is. And as you could kind of see through your article and some other things that we've discussed that probably would have made that article way too long, the likelihood of the Pelicans, say, having the 12, 13, 14, 15 pick and getting a guy who's going to actually contribute more than, say, a biannual level player and be on this team through his second contract or get traded for something of actual value, like, the data just shows that that's even more unlikely than people tend to think it is.
Yeah, I'm curious, and your very last comment, Mac, made me think about this. And if has a retroactive look been taken at some old drafts that maybe we said were really bad at the time consistently, and then end up changing? Like, is that something? I feel like your article begs the questions of, are the drafts that, you know, we at the time we evaluated as poor really bad? And also the opposite. It's super interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't look at that specifically, but I think the example that people frequently give is the 2011 draft. It wasn't supposed to be a very good draft, and it's produced a number of all-stars and all-NBA level players. Mm-hmm. And the opposite is, you know, there was that the dream draft. Mac, which one was the dream draft that recently was supposed to happen that ended up being awful?
So 2014 was supposed to be, like, and I even wrote an article the year before, but that was supposed to be the draft where you do not trade a first round pick because this is the super draft. And that was the one with Wiggins and Jabari at 1 and 2. And really not a ton has come of it, but people were touting the 2014 draft for years.
Yeah, I think I looked at it and there was 8 or 9 busts in the first round that already busted out before they concluded their rookie contract in that draft. So it was a little bit ridiculous, but no, I don't, you know, I didn't specifically look into it from that point of view. It was just more from what they did in their first contract. And I think, you know, what was surprising to me twofold is, one, the executive that I talked to all the people I talked to, I didn't share my data with them initially. I just asked them questions. They weren't even leading questions like, oh, what do you think about a player and what, you know, on their first contract versus a minimum contract? I didn't ask any of that. You know, they were very open-ended questions that I sent them a list for. I think one of them specifically was, so the two questions that were most frequently answered when I reached out were, the first question was, you know, what's the value of a rookie scale contract? Beyond, you know, you drafting a star and having a really cheap cost control star, like what's the value of a rookie scale contract? So it was a pretty open-ended question. And the second question was, you know, what's your take on drafting for need versus drafting for fit? So both pretty open-ended questions, and they weren't leading at all. And organically, the two people I talked to discussed things that I was already looking at, and I had already discussed with Mac, looking at in terms of the data. So the exec I talked to, you know, he brought up hit rate by himself. He talked about, you know, there's people I've worked with who do want to measure success with what the guy ultimately turns out to, because I guess it makes them look better as a GM in retrospect. Like, yeah, I picked that guy that ended up being good 8 years down the line, but you know, but he feels like that's not really a good way to look at it. And I agree with him, you know, that's not a good way to look at it, because what did he actually do for your team? And so I was surprised that he was aware of this issue, and he had worked with people that were kind of complicit in this retrospective look of what this guy turned out to be. But then, you know, the GM that I talked to, he went straight to comparing these guys to the like minimum replacement level players, which was, you know, the second thing that I'd spent a lot of time accumulating data, trying to build out a visual to compare. And I hadn't mentioned that at all. I didn't mention the word minimum at all in any capacity. And like, that was where they went to. And I'm like, man, like kind of blows me away that teams have already walked down this path of thinking, and they've done their own studies and they've reached their own conclusions with their own data. And I guess it shouldn't be surprising, because that's kind of literally their job, but it was surprising in the sense, because you feel like, okay, well, if they're aware of this, and then if this data kind of suggests there's this quote unquote optimal strategy of being more aggressive and going for these high upside guys, like why aren't they better? And, you know, obviously they touched upon why teams aren't better. And part of that is, you know, no one's actually great at identifying what a high upside guy is. You know, how do you identify that Draymond Green is going to be one of the best defenders of all time? You know, and so there's still a large gap between scouting, and even if you have the right philosophy and you've identified the right philosophy, doesn't necessarily mean you'll be good at it.
And so that kind of ties into something that I feel like Mac has done a really good job of over the last few years, and looking at where the undervalued players are and who the second round steals are going to be. And you've had this consistent theory, Mac, about the criteria that makes it easier to predict. Conversely, is there something you've identified at an NBA or like a top pick level that you typically would use to say these are going to be the studs?
Yeah, so to me, it's two things. It's going to be one out of two things. It'll either be elite. I don't know how to put it, because no one word defines it, but like elite physical makeup. Now, most people will take that as vertical jump or three-quarter sprint or whatever. It's not that as much as a combination of multiple things. So like Kawhi Leonard's, let's say, wingspan and hand size is part of an elite physical makeup, like something that we do not see regularly, or not even regularly, like it's amongst the top 1%, even amongst the top 1% of athletic people in the world. So it's either that or an elite 1% skill for the position. So for example, let's say Jokic is passing ability for a big man, or Clay, even in a world of shooters, he's an elite shooter. But this is what has me thinking and pushing back. Like, Mason, you brought up the thing that I've been able to predict really well for the last couple of years with the second rounders. And is it a self-fulfilling prophecy? So think about it. We're saying on one end, we'll just shoot for the high upside guys, which is usually underclassmen, you know, freak athletes, whatever. And then I could also predict the second round guys who are going to be good, because all I'm looking at is guys who don't have those traits and who are fourth year guys. And is like, my question is, let's say the Warriors take Draymond Green at 7 that year, and he doesn't have the insane high upside. Like, does he become Draymond Green, and then is this whole theory blown out of the water, or does he never become Draymond Green? Let's say the Milwaukee Bucks take Malcolm Brogdon where they took Thon McCourt instead. Like, does he become Malcolm Brogdon, or is there something about those guys getting taken in the second round, maybe not having the expectations, maybe having the chip on their shoulder, that make them become those guys? And is this all just a self-fulfilling prophecy where, no, you actually can take role players in the first round and they'll be good? We're just not doing it because history tells us to swing for the fences.
And there's also that component, I think the GM kind of touched on it, is a lot of coaches aren't really capable of putting together a developmental program for a player that they view as a role player type player. You know, they kind of want to just insert him into that role and that's it. You know, if you're a square, you're going to be a square. You're not going to ever be a triangle or, you know, a pentagon or something. Whereas if there is that high upside guy, you know, there is a Brandon Ingram that you've drafted number 2 overall, where you're like, okay, well, we're going to give him, you know, a decent amount of pick and roll situations that he can develop his reads. We're going to give him a decent amount of off the catch situations, et cetera, kind of incrementally increasing that player's game. But, you know, if you, like you said, if you drafted Brogdon or Draymond Green at number 2, does that guy ever get any of that type of development? I don't know.
Yeah. And you even look at the history of number 1 draft picks and you can kind of see that it's, to teams, it's all, I feel like it's all about, Mac, what you said about how you would value or who a true stud might be. But I feel like after you find a guy you feel like is the sure thing, teams may almost abandon that strategy and start to get more conservative and more risk averse. That's kind of how I sense how teams are reacting versus what you were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, in going to the Pelicans, the other part that I know we talked about a little bit in the group chat that isn't in the article was basically what teams do when they find their stud. Once they get their LeBron James or get their Trae Young, whatever, they immediately become less risk averse. And I could point to, you guys name a transcendent player ever, and I'll tell you the guy that they take the next year, or like once they know that guy's transcendent, and it's almost always a upperclassman with a low floor or with a low ceiling. Like, I know New Orleans fans will remember the first guy we drafted after Chris Paul, Mr. Hilton Armstrong, college senior, low ceiling, but it goes down the line with, you know, Luke Jackson being the pick after LeBron James, Dwight Howard, once he gets established, they take fourth year senior JJ Redick. And then we saw the Atlanta Hawks do it last year. They got their transcendent player, and now they immediately start drafting for need and with lower say. Like, there's no way anybody could tell me that the Hawks believe that DeAndre Hunter had the 4th highest ceiling of all the guys last year. You become less risk averse. You start picking for need and picking for roster construct. I mean, even the Thunder did it after they got their transcendent guys. They had another lotto pick that they traded up for and took Cole Aldrich. And it's just like, it's a thing that pretty much every single team does. And it always works out the same way. The only team that had any success at all with it was after getting Derrick Rose, the Bulls draft Taj Gibson, who was like 24 at the time, college senior, and that worked out okay. But yeah, that's the other team thing that teams tend to do that I would bet. Well, I don't know the Pelican. We'll see what they do, but history would say that that's what New Orleans is going to do with this pick, is they're going to take a guy for fit and a guy with
probably
ceiling. Yeah.
Have you ever heard of DealDash.com? It's the best, most honest bidding site where you can win things you never expect at a price you'd never believe. They have over 1,000 auctions every day on electronics, appliances, beauty products, home decor, and even cars. Here's how it works. It's like an auction, but every item starts at $0 and only goes up 1 cent every time you bid. The kicker is that auction clock restarts after just 10 seconds. That means every time you bid, everyone else has 10 seconds to answer or the item's yours. If you go ahead and buy now, Deal Dash is offering our listeners an extra 100 free bids upon signup on top of their other discounts. Go to DealDash.com and use the offer code Pelican or DealDash.fm/Pelican. That's DealDash.fm/Pelican. Sports are coming back, and so are your chances to bet on your favorite teams and events. Major League Baseball is finally kicking off this week, and there's no better place to start wagering than our exclusive partners, BetOnline. Check out all the odds, futures, and props to bet on, all available 24/7. And with the return of sports, BetOnline sat down with former pro players Eddie George, Harold Reynolds, and seven-time NBA champ Robert Horry. See what they had to say on what it'll be like playing without fans and a series they're calling Fandemic. Visit betonline.ag for all your odds and up-to-date sports news. Remember to use promo code BLUEWIRE to receive your new welcome bonus. That's promo code BLUEWIRE. BetOnline, your online wagering experts.
And I think to your point, the findings of this article are kind of like meant to be a jumping point rather than a conversation ender, because I think, you know, as many questions as the result of this article may have answered, I think there's as many questions left to be answered. Just like you said, what, you know, how do teams behave when they have a transcendent player? You know, what do teams do when they actually end up trading players that are on their rookie scale contract? And I think those are follow-ups that I'm definitely going to look into. I think we're probably going to look into as a group as well and see what the trends are and what this ends up producing. And I'm kind of excited to go down that road. But, you know, circling back to the conversation about these outlier level skills or physical traits, I just wanted to pick your brain on a very specific trait that may not be visible. So, like, you know, I think I look at a guy like James Harden, and I think you see this in Luka as well, but this ability to start and stop on a dime, this change of pace ability, do you consider that as one of those skills if it's in the top 1% of the 1%?
Yeah, like fluidity, like it's the thing that's keeping Jrue Holiday from being a perennial all-NBA player. Like, he has the physicalness, but like imagine, like he moves like a robot, which is crazy when you see his workout videos and how much time he puts on his body, but he doesn't have like that fluidity. And yeah, I think that's something that it's very hard to measure. And I don't know what, you know, test you would be able to do, but that herky jerkiness and that ability to stop and start, I think is an elite physical gift that can't be really added. Like, there's no world, and you put Gravis Vasquez in a gym for 20 hours a day, there's no exercises that would ever give him half of that. So yeah, I definitely think that's one of those things, and it's one of those things that is not going to really be added to your game once you get to the league.
Poor Pelicans employee Gravis Vasquez catching strays out here, man.
I mean, he was a skilled guy, a smart guy, but like, he's just the first thing that comes to my mind when I think of lead feet. Sorry, Gravis.
Hey, if he's listening, that's a win for us.
Yeah. Hey, man, he retired from coaching the Pelicans, okay? So he could focus on his body, Mac. And so he could actually start playing. I don't know. I think he wanted to end up playing for another team again. But regardless of that, you know, as far as being sure or not sure about what type of players to draft, I do think, and this isn't necessarily a product of the research, I just think this is a product of the market and kind of where the game is trending. I do think that bigs should not really be taken as high as they've gone in recent drafts, and particularly one position bigs who don't really project to have much shooting upside or guard skill level upside. I do agree with that line of thought, but it also kind of shows that, okay, well, you don't know when a guy like Paul Millsap is going to start shooting threes and become good at it. You don't know when a guy like Brook Lopez is going to start hitting threes. You know, those guys started doing that 8, 9, 10 years into their career. And so what does that look like? And in this draft and in any draft, you know, there's a good number of bigs that can do all these things a normal big can do: rebound, defend, set screens, which is fine, which is, you know, you can get a replacement level big, or you can even get a quality big for relatively cheap that can, you can do that. But like, I have no idea where you can even begin to project that this guy is going to be a good shooter at some point in his career. And I think if and when a player does get that shooting stroke, it just changes their whole trajectory. You know, it changes their value and their career outlook.
You know, it's funny that 2014 draft that we referenced, the top four guys in win shares, all centers. Jokic, Capella, Dwight Powell, I guess you could say, is a stretch big, and Joel Embiid. But at least three guys who could only play one position, play that center position. But yeah, I think the other thing you have to factor in, I think if you were to ask me why, like why this is such a conundrum, I think it all comes down to the second contract. I think that's what makes, ironically, the NBA draft so hard. It has nothing to do with the player or even the team. It has to do with being on the clock for that second contract. And I think the second contract in the NBA, like, you're going to find very few guys who get properly paid in the second contract. You're either going to massively overpay a guy to keep him because he's 23, 24, and in order to keep him, you have to overpay to keep him from going to other teams, or you're going to find a guy who gets massively underpaid because he's already been given up on, and then he becomes a Ben McLemore or something like that who just signs wherever for the league minimum. But I really think that's the biggest problem with the NBA draft. Is I look at a team like the Atlanta Hawks, and basically 2.5 years in, they're on the clock on Tayshaun Prince, and they're like, okay, what are we going to do? Are we going to pay this guy, the or Taurean Prince, yeah. Are we going to pay this guy the $15 to $20 million he wants, knowing that, you know, we could probably get a similar player for the MLE? Or are we going to just let him go for nothing? And they don't want to do that either. So basically they trade him for a pick that is right around the range that they took him at, and now they're going to kick the can forward, probably take another guy who's similar, face another decision like that in 2 or 3 years. To me, that's the problem. It's not really that a guy's good or bad or not a fit or fit whatever. It's that you have to decide whether you're going to overpay a guy or let him go for nothing or trade him for whatever you could get by like year three. You look at a guy like Nickeil Alexander-Walker, like that decision's coming sooner than we think. Either he's going to stink and you're just going to not pick up the option. He's going to be kind of just good enough to pick up the option, but not really good enough to have any trade value. Or he's going to show just enough flashes to where you're going to have to pay him more than what he deserves to be paid based on his production. And it's just, that to me is what makes it so hard. And the only way to kind of like to be okay with that decision is to draft a guy who's great and then you don't mind paying him. But the why of all this is the second NBA contract.
So I'm curious, a follow-up on that, and I think it's really interesting because I would argue that the opposite's true for four-year play or for guys that have been in college for either 3 or 4 years and then you draft them. So I'm now your comments have me wondering, you know, is it the right play in certain situations because of what you just said to take the guy who's coming out of college at 21, 22, and by the time they're hitting their second contract, this is like the Malcolm Brogdon argument. He's yep. basically in his prime. And so you feel less risk in saying this contract, by the time he's come up for the second contract, I feel like I have a good idea of what he's going to be or what he is. And so if you're maxing him out, you got to feel pretty good about it because he's coming up through his prime years. And if you're overpaying a guy at that point, then joke's on you. Right.
So and you don't even have to max him out. Like
right.
he gets offered less than freaking Otto Porter does. But Otto Porter gets offered all that because he was the number 3 pick and because he was still young with quote unquote upside. So yeah, like take the college senior, you know yeah. what they are. And even if they are good, you're not going to have to overpay them because the GM's not going to be disillusioning themselves with some mm-hmm. kind of crazy upside.
I think that it's kind of twofold there, right? Because one, it goes back into this idea of knowing who's going to be good or knowing who's not going to be good. And there really isn't a reliable way to predict it because, you know, you have a college of a 4 or was it maybe 5 year college player in Siakam. You know, he's a star level player now. And his max is going to be for the duration of his prime. And that's right. a player that's exceeding, you know, any value that he could have produced on his draft slot. But he's like a legitimate star level player that makes a difference on a team. But, you know, on the other side, it's, I think Mac and I talked about this offline a little bit, this idea of going for those 4 year college guys. I don't know if it's the best strategy, but it may be a really good strategy to do in the second round where, you know, you have a bunch of picks and you blowing a pick doesn't really have much impact on your franchise's trajectory as, you know, you say blowing the 10th pick or something like that. And you can also get cheap production that you'll be able to cost control later. And there's a relatively high floor upside. But again, it kind of goes back to this idea of like, who's going to be good and how do you identify that?
But that's only an option to take those guys in the second round because everybody's doing the strategy that we're telling them to do. And apparently they already know to do. But in retrospect, like the Warriors should have taken Draymond Green at 7, not waited to 35. So like if other teams become more hip to the, oh, you know, maybe this isn't the right strategy and now we start taking senior guy. Like think about it this way. You take RJ Hampton and let's take somebody like Tyler Bay, who's almost 23 years old. And they have the same amount of production through their rookie contract, whether that's average, whether that's above average, whatever. We do know for a fact who's going to get a much, much bigger contract offer for contract number 2. So, no, you're never going to know who's going to be good, who's going to be great, who's not going to be good. But you could play all the outcomes. And I look at a guy like RJ Hampton and the only way that it turns out good for me is if he's so good that he's worth a max contract. Because the scenario where he's like a B level player and then now it's extension time, I'm screwed in that scenario. C level player, I'm probably even a little screwed there. D or F, he's nothing. So like every scenario for RJ Hampton is bad outside of him becoming an all-star, quasi all-star, and then me being willing to pay him. Versus like Tyler Bay, I could draw up a lot of solid scenarios in which I don't get myself into a bad situation 3-4 years down the line. So like to me, that's where the debate kind of lies.
So do you think a couple things here and to first, do you think that kind of contradicts what we talked about earlier with teams becoming less risk averse when they have their franchise level player and then they opt to go for 4 year guys? Do you think that's what they're thinking? Like, okay, we don't want to end up in a situation where we're, you know, capped out paying a B-level player or a C-plus level player, you know, get someone that has a relatively high floor outcome and we know what we're getting out of. You know, I mean, obviously the logic is there, but does that validate their strategy more? And two, on a larger scale, does the findings of what we found in the article and kind of what we're talking about here, does that kind of indirectly invalidate Dell Demps' whole draft strategy? We're like, okay, like, I'm just not even going to deal with the draft. Let me go and be aggressive with these picks, get players who I think are going to fit my core and my timeline. And you know, like, without with the way the Pelicans are, they're not getting a Drew Holiday level player in free agency. They're not. At least maybe they will in Zion's future, but they just weren't the organization to get that kind of player. But they had the ability to trade for that level of player, you know, if not draft him, and they capitalize on that. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad strategy. So is kind of Dell's approach validated in this as well?
I think Dell gave the new – it's always weird to talk about them back then. Like, do you call them the New Orleans team? Like, do you call them the Pelicans for when Chris Paul was on the team? Or, like, do you call them the Hornets? It gets so confusing. But anyway, if the goal is to be a 50-win team and a playoff team every year and, you know, be better than average with the chance to – maybe sneak your way into a Western Conference final or final. Dell Demps' play was by far the better play. If your goal is to be the number one team out of 30, and that's the only goal, and everything else is a failure, then no. What you should do every single year is swing for the fences. And, I mean, that year he traded for Drew, if he takes Giannis, like – it is very possible that we are looking at a dynasty right now, even though we wouldn't have Zion. So, no, it depends what the goal is. But
Can we tie that back to Ryan's annual articles too, though, and like the value of a draft pick? Like, I think you were kind of alluding to this, Mac, but just, you know, should we be revisiting what the – value of this pick is in the context of you know, how, what they did for the team that drafted them? And as such, are valuations that teams are placing on picks and relativity? So obviously, like, you still value the number one pick way more, but, you know, how is the difference between, say, the 15th pick and the 7th pick that much, like, not quite as different as maybe what we've originally assessed?
Yeah, see, what I would do if I had the time, and honestly, if I had the desire to as much anymore, is I would do kind of what Ryan did, but do it based on what is still on the board. So, like, to me, it's completely stupid and somewhat arbitrary to be like, the 6th pick yields this on average, the 7th pick yields that on average, and even grouping it in a range. What I would like to see is, like, okay, at the 6th pick, there are an average of this many A-level players on the board. On the 12th pick, there's an average of this many A-level guys who became A-level players still on the board. Like, to me, that's the right way to do it, because it's kind of arbitrary where Jimmy Butler was taken, for instance. But he was an A-level player that was still on the board at both picks. I forget the example you gave, but both picks 7 and 12, let's say. So you still have the opportunity to get as good of an opportunity to get Jimmy Butler at either of those picks. So I would like to see the data with that, you know, kind of figured out, because there is a drop point from what I've seen just going back on drafts. Like, there becomes a point where in every draft, there is an A-level player that goes somewhere between 7 and 12, 7 and 13. But usually there's only one in that kind of cluster, and then even for the next 10 picks after that. And it usually does fall off at a certain point where, like, at pick 7, you would have, history says you have 3.7 A player is still on the board, but at pick 12, it's somewhere around 1.3. So that's a long way of saying that that's kind of how I would like to see it going forward, to be looked at as we look back at old drafts.
Yeah. So like I said, it's we have a lot of data. Part of this was me picking up, you know, I think I talked to Mason about this on a podcast months ago, but it was me trying to pick up and refine some of my Python skills and being able to extract the data from the places we need to. So I think we're in a spot where we do have a good bit of data, and those are areas that we can explore. And I'm looking forward to continuing to do some of that research. And hopefully, you know, the findings are as illuminating as they were this time around, but definitely an area to keep evaluating.
For 60 months on new vehicles with PenFed.
You are aware that you don't have to be a military member to save hundreds on your auto loan, aren't you? Anyone can join PenFed.
As someone terrified of heights, I probably should have looked into that.
Probably.
Drop me off at the shore.
PenFed Credit Union. Visit PenFed.org/autos or call 1-800-247-5626. Advertised rates available through the PenFed Car Buying Service. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.